Miles automatically, so you don't have to. Try it for free at carbonite.com.
You're watching Money Clip on Bloomberg Television, fully digital. So download our BTV Plus app. It's free, of course. I am Adam Johnson. All right, time now for today's moving pictures, where the video is the story. We're looking at what used to be the airport in Donetsk. It's now in ruins after heavy fighting between pro-Russian rebels and Ukrainian government troops has obviously left it in this state of disarray. Local officials say at least three civilians were killed. And eastern Ukraine has suffered its worst violence in more than a week in spite of a ceasefire deal. And in Japan, rescue workers were forced to suspend plans to recover at least two dozen bodies near the volcano that erupted this weekend. 36 people were killed. Increased seismic activities raising concerns about another possible eruption. And Chelsea Clinton left a New York City hospital last night with her new baby, daughter, husband, and proud grandparents, Bill and Hillary, of course. They all paused for pictures before getting into cars that were waiting outside. The Clintons announced the birth of Charlotte Clinton Mizvinsky on Twitter and Facebook over the weekend. Well, around the world, Hong Kong streets were filled once again with pro-democracy protesters. This was overnight, but this time, as it turns out, there was no tear gas. Here's Bloomberg News reporter Andrew Davis, who's been on the ground.
The atmosphere out there last night was incredible, actually. The tear gas attack was 2 days ago. Last night, the police were basically nowhere to be seen. They let the protesters have their way in three parts of the city. And the protesters, unlike the kind of demonstrations we tend to see in Europe or the U.S., they really aren't looking to provoke the police at all. Mm-hmm. So there was absolutely no violence. It was very festive last night, as a matter of fact. And people seemed to be having a really good time. And the police were really nowhere to be seen. It was very, very calm. And it is today as well.
Tell us about the character of the protest and the character of the protesters. These are university students, high school and college students, but also some of the veterans of the democracy movements in the past, professors, politicians who make up Occupy Central have now joined them, haven't they?
Yeah, this Occupy Central movement had hinted that they were going to begin their occupation of Central tomorrow for the holiday. The students got out ahead of them, and the students are the ones that are really, really bringing the numbers. Occupy said initially that they hoped to get 10,000 people. Last night, there were probably more than 100,000 between the three different points, and that's mostly because of the energy of the students. What I saw last night when I was out there in the main protest area, it was overwhelmingly young people. The complexion could change a bit more tomorrow because it's a holiday both tomorrow and Thursday. So more people that may have been in their office and might want to participate, might have wanted to participate, may very well be out there tomorrow. And if it stays calm like this, we could see quite a turnout.
The demonstrators want free elections and the city's chief executive to resign, but he says China will not budge in its decision to limit voting reforms. We spoke to the founder of the Hong Kong Democratic Party, which supports these protests.
The world has seen how peaceful our demonstrators are. I mean, they raise their hands, whereas the police are fully armed, and many police vehicles were abandoned and surrounded by the protesters. Anywhere in the world, they would actually burn the police vehicles or turn them upside down. But these vehicles in Hong Kong were not even touched by the people. And they're such a peaceful, loving crowd. They just want democracy. And they have demonstrated with peace and love, as they were told to do.
Well,
certainly, the decent thing for the chief executive to do is to persuade Beijing to deliver democracy in Hong Kong as promised. And then, hopefully, one day, China will also take that route. And the world will be a much better world if China is democratic.
Well, as noted, police have not used tear gas since the weekend. Observers wonder where the decision to use that tactic came from in the first place.
I cannot believe the police spokesman that the decision was made by the senior officer in charge at the scene. No way. Such a decision could only come from Beijing. There's no doubt at all about it. Nobody in Hong Kong dares to make that decision.
And now Hong Kong's chief executive is telling protesters to go home, but will they?
No, unless it delivers something to Hong Kong people. Actually, what we're asking for is already promised to us, but which was delayed and delayed and delayed. So we're asking for something which we're entitled to, and it is up to our chief executive to get it for us. But instead, it's always on Beijing's side and denying genuine democracy to the people of Hong Kong. That's why the people are clamoring for him to step down. I think that's a very reasonable request.
Hong Kong's leader has called on the protests to end immediately. All right, coming up, U.S. fast food brands are going global. From Dunkin' Donuts in India to Domino's in the U.K., we're going to hear from the CEOs of both. That's next in Eats. And as we head to break, you may notice in this recent video that North Korean leader Kim Jong-un is not walking normally. According to a South Korean newspaper, he's having ankle problems and is currently in the hospital recovering from surgery that actually was on both ankles.
Listen up for an amazing offer that can change the way you hear.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. Can you repeat that?
Frustrated with your hearing?
What did he say?
Well, hear better now. Introducing the fully rechargeable MSA30X, a revolutionary device that features the latest microsound amplification technology that can barely be seen. Independently tested to help you hear up to 30 times better. It turns ordinary hearing into extraordinary hearing. MSA30X works by capturing and amplifying sound waves, yet its lightweight ergoacoustic design is discreet. It form fits in and around either ear.
I forget I'm even wearing it.
An MSA30X is powerful. Hear clearly in restaurants. Never miss another word on TV or at the movies.
My wife complains that I have the volume up on the TV too loud.
And I didn't want to be in the same room with them.
Now I can hear everything clearly.
Simply adjust the volume as you desire. Other units use so many batteries, and they're difficult to change. But the MSA30X is completely rechargeable. Simply plug it into the wall.
I tried other devices that had batteries, but they were always such a pain to change and so costly. But this is rechargeable, so I figure I save hundreds a year.
Bulky sound amplifiers can cost hundreds, but try MSA30X for just $59.95, and we'll include a cleaning brush and five comfort tips. But wait. In this special TV offer, we'll cut the price in half. Now you can hear up to 30 times better for just $29.95. But there's even more. We'll double the offer free. Just pay additional processing and handling. Wear them both or give one to a loved one. Did you hear that? That's two MSA30Xs for just $29.95. The MSA30X Hear Better Now offer. Get two for just $29.95.
All I can say is just try it. It could change your life.
To order, you can call 1-800-804-5317. That's 1-800-804-5317. Or you can go to msa30x.com. Call or click now.
The challenges that industry or enterprise faces the most is the consumerization of IT. Companies are having to increasingly be aware of their employee base, consuming of mobile technology and capability, and bringing that into the business and trying to leverage it in their daily work. Security is even more important in the consumerization of IT. Samsung has addressed this by bringing in a security framework to help the enterprise actually get the balance of both. Samsung's doing a lot to help our businesses meet those changes and those challenges. I believe we're the right solution for them. Samsung is committed to a holistic approach in meeting the needs of our enterprise customers in the areas of security, software, solutions, and support.
Realize the full potential of mobility. Find out more at Bloomberg.com/ad/mobile next.
So you're talking about a show that's kind of like what we did in our books.
Exactly. The high human drama of politics. And politics is fun.
But the show should be about more than politics. About politics and sports and entertainment and culture. The whole thing.
Exactly. It's like a taco bar and a sushi bar all in one.
That sounds pretty good.
This is Money Clip on Bloomberg Television, and we are streaming live everywhere. We are online. We're on your phone and tablet. We're on Apple TV and Amazon Fire TV. I'm Adam Johnson. Well, in Eats, the breakfast wars are heating up as more fast food chains like Taco Bell are offering coffee, pastries, and eggs, trying to attract customers. It's a thorn in the side of one Nigel Travis, CEO of Dunkin' Brands. He joined the Market Makers team, and advertising executive Jason DeLand, they were talking about this new competition this morning. He says it all starts with coffee.
Coffee is a big business. I mean, looking at some numbers, coffee has increased on average 5.6% for the last 5 or 6 years. It's now nearly $28 billion. That's both grocery and restaurants together. People, as you say, love coffee. It's continuing to grow. It's continuing to grow internationally. Like us, we're continuing to grow all the way around the world. So I think coffee is part of the battle, but breakfast is the broader part of the same battle.
How do you take somebody else's coffee drinker?
The answer is, I think when we go into a new market and we're growing very quickly across the U.S., we get a lot of customers from independent stores. We get some from some of the chain competitors. And one of the things we're very lucky, we have a lot of transplants. I mean, we had queues right around the block when we opened in California the other week. And by the way, just to prove it's not only California, Bangalore in India 2 weeks ago, southern India, we had the same kind of result.
Do you find that the breakfast day part is the most loyal day part within the category?
I think it's loyal, but virtually everyone who goes to Starbucks, Dunkin' Donuts, McDonald's goes to another chain the same week. People
a different chain.
Yeah, a different chain. People are driven by convenience. They're driven by offers. They're driven by great service, and that's why we focus so much on our service and speed and new ideas.
Well, Travis also shared his thoughts on Burger King's acquisition of Canadian Coffee and donut chain Tim Hortons.
We've really got our franchisees fired up about that. Any merger, which by definition means disruption, usually means cost savings, is an opportunity for us. Our franchisees really see this as a great opportunity to grow, to cement their strength in various markets. We're very, very excited about the fact that they're going to spend 2 years working on this merger and all the distractions that go with it. I think it's great for us. It's great for our franchisees.
Do you worry at all about the possibility of Tim Hortons coming down here and being such a loved and trusted brand in Canada?
Well, we battle with Tim Hortons every day of the week up around the Canadian border. They've shut down a lot of stores over the last 2 or 3 years in places like Providence, Hartford, Maine. So we've done very well. They've done well in a couple of markets. But our franchisees are very competitive, as am I. So we're going to take advantage of that. But so far, I think the opportunity for them to go really deep into America has yet to be proven.
And now for an American brand that's going after Brits. We're talking about Domino's Pizza. CEO of the company's UK-based operations, David Wild, spoke with our Caroline Hyde from the World Retail Congress in Paris. That was this morning.
I think the most important thing in retail is to satisfy your customers and understand the direction that your customers are going, because that's how you win. You win by satisfying your customers. Now, one of the things we've been very good at within Domino's is recognizing that customers want to order more online. And this may seem paradoxical, the easier you make it for customers to order pizza, the more pizzas they'll order. So online's a great vehicle for doing that. And the other benefit of online is it makes it easier for our colleagues working in the stores, because instead of having to take information down from the phone, it's straight onto the PC, which goes to the make line. So it's much more efficient, and it's more accurate as well. Because, if somebody's taking something down on the phone, there's always a danger that actually the pizza topping won't be quite what the customer wanted. So it's a win in terms of customer preference, but it's also a win in terms of operational effectiveness. And the great news is our online customers spend more money than people who call us. So really, it's just a win in every direction.
And it's 70% at the moment, yeah, orders online.
Yeah.
Where do you see that going by next year?
We're not setting any targets for it, because it's just grown so rapidly. What we're more focused on are the inputs of how we make it easier for customers to order online and how we show the broader range of products that we offer online. Because again, the great benefit of online is you can show people meal deals, you can show them the variety of products that we sell to accompany the pizza. And that's a way of deepening our relationship with the customer. And we can also do things like retaining last order, retaining credit card. So again, it's easier for customers.
The pizza's making me hungry. Now, before joining Domino's, David Wild served as the CEO of UK car parts store Halfords. He also held senior roles at Walmart and Tesco. All right, next in pop, why award-winning actor Kevin Spacey wants to, quote, send the elevator back down. I promise we will explain.
We all think about life insurance. But when we start worrying about tomorrow, we miss out on the things that matter today. At AXA, we offer advice and help you break down your insurance goals into small, manageable steps. Because when you plan for tomorrow, it helps you live for today. Can we help you take a small step? For advice, retirement, and life insurance, connect with AXA.
Can a polo build your brand? At Lands' End Business Outfitters, we help build brands by combining quality clothing, expert embroidery, and legendary service. For 20 years, we've created brand right looks for thousands of businesses just like yours. And when you're wearing your logo, you're building your brand. Customers recognize it. Employees take pride in it. Your image improves with it. Your brand grows with us.
Single Christians, good news. ChristianMingle.com has over 13 million registered members. Nearly 4 million new members in the past year alone. Every day, members send more than 200,000 messages. I sent one of those messages and met my beautiful wife. That's good news. Join today and find God's match for you. Sometimes we wait for God to make the next move when God is saying it's your time to act. The next move is yours. Joining is easy and free. Join ChristianMingle.com today.
Partnerships occur when both share a passion for improving, for growing in harmony. Speak from the heart and respect the other. Feeling of being comfortable, of being open, that creates the true partnership, which ensures the greatest success. Together, invest in remarkable Indonesia.
What does Silicon Valley get that other industries don't yet?
Bloomberg's Emily Chang sits down with the biggest influencers in technology and media.
Honestly, in the beginning, we were not trying to make money.
It was all an experiment. You think that you may live to 120.
I certainly hope to, yes. I'm a little paranoid of not being needed and wanted, I guess.
For candid conversations about how they made it and where they're going next, Studio 1.0, Thursday at 9 on Bloomberg Television.
This is Money Clip on Bloomberg Television, and we're streaming live everywhere, including on your Windows device. I'm Adam Johnson. Well, activist investor Carl Icahn, he gets his way at eBay, which announces a spinoff of PayPal. So the question is, who's next? It's topic number one on Bloomberg West today. Emily Chang is joining us. And Emily, which other well-known tech companies are in the activist crosshairs right now?
Yahoo under a lot of pressure, Adam. Starboard Value, the activist investor, saying Yahoo should be merging with AOL, that could unlock a lot of value, that Yahoo is worth more. The sum of its parts are worth more than Yahoo currently is today. We're going to be talking about that. But really, the story of the day is PayPal spinning off from eBay. Huge reversal from eBay CEO John Donahoe. We've got some members of the PayPal mafia. PayPal co-founder Max Levchin will be joining us, as well as former PayPal vice president Keith Raboy. Both of them have had strong thoughts throughout the last year, and I know John Donahoe has personally talked to these guys about what he should do. In fact, Keith Raboy has been pretty outspoken that this is what they should have done from the very beginning, so we're going to be getting their thoughts on the news today now that it is official, Adam.
Yeah, right. You know, let me just ask you quickly, Emily. Obviously, Yahoo's got a lot of money now because it owns Alibaba, so that's a newfound wealth. It could actually go out in theory and buy AOL, but what would AOL and Yahoo actually look like, and what would they do if they came together?
You know, Adam, I'm wondering the very same thing. We're going to be talking to Gene Munster about that. These are two struggling companies. So do two struggling companies together make a better company? Can they really sell more ads together? It really is about the advertising. I believe they are losing hundreds of millions of dollars on it. So can they lose less if they are a joint company? That's a big question. Obviously, Yahoo has the winnings from Alibaba, but could it be better spent on a company that's actually doing really well? That's the question.
Yeah, right. Well, you have piqued my curiosity. I will be watching. Thanks, Emily. And you, of course, can also watch Emily. Bloomberg West comes on at 1 o'clock, 6 o'clock, and 11 p.m. Eastern right here on Bloomberg Television. Okay, today in pop, Academy Award winner Kevin Spacey may play the ruthless Frank Underwood in Netflix House of Cards, but off-screen, very different story. Spacey's foundation, aptly named the Kevin Spacey Foundation, supports emerging artists in performing arts and film. He held a fundraiser last night, and it drew big names from Hollywood and Washington. Here's why this is so important to him.
There's also these other moments that are not about the money. These moments that happen in workshops where, you know, I was the shy kid in the corner when I started, when I was 10, 11, 12, 13. And so I'm always looking for the shy kid in the corner. Because I do these workshops, they last about 3.5 hours usually. And that's the kid I want. I want to be able to get that kid who's sitting in the corner, wanting to be involved but not knowing how, too shy to stand up, where you slowly start to coax them. And in a process of 3 hours, you can watch someone have a moment when they finally get up and they finally do something, stand up for themselves, do a scene in front of their peers, have to speak. You literally see the light and like the nickel drop in their eye. And I know what that feels like. And that's a feeling I don't want to ever get too far away from. And that's a feeling that every time it happens, it's the most thrilling thing in the world. That for me is more valuable than the money.
Very thoughtful perspective. So how was Spacey able to get some of the most powerful names in Washington, look, from totally opposite sides of the aisle, to actually get behind the arts together?
It's probably the power of Frank Underwood. It has nothing to do with me. They're afraid of crossing Frank, I suspect. But look, last year we had a dinner here. It was a different kind of an evening. And it was the night that they were voting whether or not to shut down the government. And they all came, and then they went and voted. Of course, I think they voted wrong, but they voted. So I'm delighted to be able to do something, particularly in the arts, you know. Government always has this sort of argument, and every year the Nancy Hanks lecture happens and all these kids and teachers come across the country to try to make an argument for why arts and culture are an important thing in the nation and why the government should support arts and culture. And now we're starting to see in all of these wonderful areas across the country where colleges are starting to look at a STEM education, but they're starting to add an A in a lot of states, so it becomes STEAM, and the A is for arts. I think that's an extraordinarily important thing to continue to try to encourage.
Well, like we said earlier, it was a concert benefit, and it turns out Spacey can actually sing. This is today's Loose Change.
Surplus energy into the plant, which generously lowered its price, and tipped off the house, which used all that energy to stay warm through the storm.
There's a bad storm coming.
The Internet of Everything is changing how energy works. Is your network ready?
We're at a place in our lives where we need investment income. That's why we invest in tax-free municipal bonds.
We love the income they provide us, income that's federally tax-free. And at this point in our lives, tax-free income is exactly what we need.
Tax-free municipal bonds can serve as the cornerstone for a conservative portfolio. They offer income that's tax-free. Henning & Walsh is a leading expert in tax-free municipal bonds, committed to finding you the best bonds to meet your investment goals. We'll even send you our informative bond guide absolutely free if you call right now. 1-800-895-7895. If you have at least $10,000 to invest, consider municipal bonds. They provide income that's federally tax-free. Take charge of your investments today. Call now to receive your free copy of our informative bond guide. It's free, so call now. 1-800-895-7895. That's 1-800-895-7895.
Time now for Bloomberg Television on the Markets. I'm Matt Miller. Let's get you caught up on where stocks closed out the day and the quarter, really, as we finished with a red arrow on the S&P for the day. 1972, down 5.5 points, but up for the 7th consecutive quarterly gain. So not a bad track record for stocks, even on a red day. Now, take a look at the dollar. Speaking of a track record, it has been on a roll lately as well. Here you see a euro trading at 126, a pound at 162, and 109.64 yen to the dollar. It has gotten stronger and stronger. For more on the markets and how the stronger dollar could impact Fed policy, I want to bring in Eric Stein. He's vice president and co-director of the Global Income Group at Eaton Vance. This is something we've been noticing here at Bloomberg for a while. And the Fed doesn't seem to, not that they don't see it, but they don't seem to really care that much. It's interesting.
You've had a couple Fed speeches the past couple weeks, including New York Fed President Dudley, and I think your question is exactly on point. They acknowledged it, but they didn't seem overly concerned. I think everyone's right now talking about the dollar's strength, and certainly the past couple months the dollar's been strong, but from a longer-term perspective, the dollar's still at a fairly weak level.
Now, I'm a bit of a cynic, and growing up, I've always thought it was funny that the Fed seemed to have a policy of weakening the dollar as much as possible to boost our exports, and then go out and say, we have a strong dollar policy, and Treasury would say the same thing, but you knew they were lying. Do they now really have a strong dollar policy?
Well, I mean, the Fed would never admit that they touched the currency. They'd say that's in the purview of Treasury. Obviously, right. With quantitative easing and other Fed policies, they affect the currency. I think they think of how does the currency affect the real economy, output, job growth, and inflation. That's what they're focused on.
So we are expecting Fed, most people that we talk to are expecting the Fed to raise rates. How will a stronger dollar affect that? I mean, if we continue to see the dollar strengthen, how does that play into the inflation and rate change?
So you can think of the dollar as having somewhat of kind of counterbalancing effect. So the extent the dollar strengthens, that means inflation comes down a little lower. We're importing things cheaper. It's also maybe a little bit of a headwind to growth for exporters. Keep in mind, though, the U.S., we don't trade as much as other countries. So a stronger dollar doesn't hurt us as much as some of the other exporting nations.
And we see a lot of those other exporting nations doing the reverse of U.S. Fed policy. I mean, people expecting more QE from Europe and even the Bank of Japan, right?
Exactly. So, you know, Japan is a classic example of an export-led economy. They want a weaker yen to help the export recovery, to help the Abenomics kind of plan go through. In Europe, it's to some extent exports, but it's also the currency was just painfully high back at 140. And if the Eurozone is going to continue and go on as a going concern and hopefully recover at some point, they needed a weaker currency. That's what Draghi saw.
Are they the most flagrant currency manipulator of the big three, the Japanese?
Probably, because they actually talk about it and target it. But you know what? Draghi started talking about it and targeting. I think all the countries do it at various times, at various points of time. They're probably all the most flagrant.
All right. Hey, Eric, great having you on. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Eric Stein there from Eaton Vance. Now, for more on the markets, tune into Bloomberg every 30 minutes at 26 and 56. I'm Matt Miller. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
Edward Jones, this is Shirley speaking. How may I help you? Oh, hey, Neil. How are you? How was the trip?
With nearly 7 million investors...
He's right here. Hold on one second.
You'd expect us to have a highly skilled call center.
Kevin, Neil Hawley's on line one.
Okay, great.
And we do. It's how Edward Jones makes sense of investing.
Around the clock, around the world, Bloomberg keeps you connected. On television, online, on the radio, and on mobile.
New York State is jumpstarting business with Startup New York, an unprecedented program that partners businesses with universities across the state for better access to talent, cutting-edge research, and state-of-the-art facilities. And you pay no taxes for 10 years. From biotech in Brooklyn to next-gen energy in Binghamton to manufacturing in Buffalo, Startup New York has new businesses popping up across the state. See how Startup New York can help your business grow at startup.ny.gov.
Clicks are off the charts.
Yeah.
Yoshi, we're back.
Yes, sir!
Start your day so you make better investment decisions.
You watch Bloomberg Surveillance to find out what the markets are doing. And you talk to smart people. Bloomberg Surveillance, weekdays at 6 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Television.
From our studios in New York City, this is Charlie Rose.
We begin the scene with China. It is a moment of turmoil in Hong Kong. Thousands of people have taken to the streets of this Chinese city in protest over new legislative rules from Beijing. Over the weekend, the protesters were met with tear gas and pepper spray. The conflict has escalated into one of the largest demonstrations Hong Kong has seen since the Tiananmen Square massacre of 1989. And it raises new questions about the city's role and the rights of its citizens in modern China. Joining me now, Orville Schell. He is the Arthur Ross Director of the Center on U.S.-China Relations at the Asia Society. His new book with John DeLory is called Wealth and Power, China's Long March to the 21st Century. And Nicholas Buckland, he is a senior researcher for Human Rights Watch based in Hong Kong. He is currently a visiting scholar at the China Center at Yale Law School, has lived in China, in Hong Kong for some 20 years. I am pleased to have both of them here. Nicholas, let me just go and have you explain to us what is happening. What's the conflict?
Well, to put it simply, it's the Hong Kong people making their voices heard. They're making their voices heard to their local government, the Hong Kong government, and to Beijing as well. The crux of the matter is the governance of Hong Kong. The chief executive of Hong Kong was nominated by Hong Kong, by Beijing, sorry. The chief of the executive is handpicked by Beijing, and the Hong Kong people don't feel that he is representing their interests. And in particular, Beijing had promised that the next chief executive would be elected through universal suffrage. And Beijing is not keeping its promise. It has laid out some rules that say that Beijing will pick the candidates that the Hong Kong electorate can vote for, therefore screening out any candidate that Beijing doesn't like. The Hong Kong public doesn't like it. Hong Kong students don't like it. And the result is the protest that we're seeing
and
today.
And what's the risk for the Chinese government in Beijing?
Well, Beijing, I think, has been quite tone deaf to the demand of the Hong Kong people. But really, it is a conflict about the governance of Hong Kong. The Hong Kong people want to maintain their way of life, which is different from the mainland. Hong Kong has a high degree of autonomy. It has the rule of law. It has a free press. It has freedom of expression. Hong Kong people want to keep this. They have a different language. They have a different history and culture. And they don't want to be assimilated into an authoritarian one-party mainland. The Hong Kong government, however, has sided with Beijing and with the big property tycoons in Hong Kong and not represented Hong Kong people's interests. And that is really what is driving and fueling these protests. The one-party system and the fact that the party is a monopoly on power in Beijing is not really the target of the demonstrators.
When I asked what were the risks, I meant to ask is, in fact, does this have a possibility of spreading and jumping from Hong Kong to China because of the idea of people incorporating it into their own protest about human rights or whatever issue there might be, democracy, well, local control?
Yeah, well, the rulers in Beijing never liked, they never liked a demonstration, and they never liked to hear people expressing their voices. But I think the risk of contagion is quite limited. This is, above all, a conflict about autonomy, how much autonomy Hong Kong people should have and how much Beijing is ready to give them. This is not a conflict about the monopoly on state power by the Communist Party.
Okay. Do you think the Chinese government is prepared to make some compromises here?
You know, I think the climate in Beijing now is quite rigid. And I think one of the results of China's success economically, which is quite a success story, is that they've accrued a certain level of confidence, even arrogance. And it's coupled also with a certain kind of insecurity historically derived, which means that they're becoming more and more obdurate in how they approach problems, both within their country and also outside of their country.
So therefore they're unlikely to compromise because they're arrogant and insecure?
I had a person well-placed in Beijing tell me the other day that he would not be surprised if ultimately if the Occupy Central movement in Hong Kong came full-blown, which it now has, that they might send in People's Liberation Army troops. Now, that was, for me, having seen, you know, the results of 1989 in Beijing, where nobody could quite believe they would send troops in, but they did. So I think this is an extremely a dangerous prospect that lies on the horizon, that China, feeling humiliated, feeling insulted, feeling their authority challenged in Hong Kong, could move to quash the students.
Could you imagine that happening?
Well, I don't think that it is likely at the very moment, because Beijing has a lot of options. It can force the chief executive, which is deeply unpopular, to resign. And this is actually the main demand of the Occupy Central movement.
They've done that before. They replaced the chief executive before.
Exactly. He was replaced after a million Hong Kong people took the streets to oppose the passing of drastic, draconian anti-subversion legislation. The problem is that even if Beijing was sending the People's Liberation Army to Hong Kong, it would not end dissent in Hong Kong. It would not end protest against Beijing rule. People would retreat. They would not try to confront the PLA, as in 1989. The organizers have made that very clear. But you would see massive emigration, and you would see a continued opposition to Beijing. It would make the city ungovernable. And so this is really an option for Beijing only if the party feels threatened itself, which it did in 1989. I don't think it's the case right now. If there is no contagion of protests in the rest of China, but I don't see this happening. This is really about autonomy. Beijing is doing a terrible job of managing its peripheries and places that it has promised autonomy to.
But you have talked about a friend who worries that the city may become another Tibet.
Yes, I think that it is for Hong Kong people who benefit from freedom of information and a free press. They've been increasingly aware of the authoritarian nature of the regime in Beijing. What was unthinkable even a few years ago, that is that you have a strong confrontation and Beijing using force, is now at the back of the mind of Hong Kong people. But this is precisely this prospect that they're trying to stop before it gets there.
Oh, you've been writing about China for a long time, and you've been going to China for a long time. How has China changed because of Xi Jinping?
Well, he has surprised us, I think. His kind of emphatic quality, in essence, saying that the old system of Western pressure is no longer to be tolerated. And there's much more a sense in Beijing now that China is going to be in the world on its own terms. And this poses a whole lot of new questions for the United States and the West. How do we deport ourselves in relationship to this country, which now is much less willing to yield, accommodate, make concessions? And so all around, and particularly in Asia, we do see a much more militant posture.
Do we see a forward projection of that in terms of pushing forward Chinese power?
Well, look at its posture towards the Philippines, in Vietnam and island disputes, Malaysia, Brunei, Indonesia, and its posture towards Japan in island disputes. We find it very obdurate, very sort of unwilling to contemplate any sorts of concessions or accommodations. And I think this has sort of been 150 years of history sort of working itself out to the point where China has gotten to the point where they're able to say, we are not going to accommodate.
Are you surprised by that?
No, I think that for the past 20 years, this is what we've been saying. We've been saying that it was a fantasy to hope that giving Beijing everything it wanted, investment, cooperation, technology, respect on the international stage without any counterpart, was a losing tactic, and that all it would do is encourage and strengthen the one-party system and its intolerant attitude. And this is exactly what we're getting.
Has there been any progress under Xi Jinping on human rights?
No, it hasn't.
Has it gone the other way?
It's gone the other way. There's been a considerable slide back.
How is it expressed?
Well, there's been a tightening on the internet, a crackdown on the press, a strengthening of the ideological controls, a crackdown in Xinjiang, Tibet, and the arrest of many human rights and civil society leaders. Just last week, a Uyghur academic who was advocating for better understanding between Uyghur, ethnic right. minority group right. from northwest China, and the Chinese was sentenced to a life sentence. That shows a really very strong authoritarian, hostile attitude from the governments.
At the same time, China's going through its own sort of push to do something about pollution on the one hand, and also corruption on the other hand.
Well, I think the Communist Party recognizes that, you know, it has to deliver on more than just sort of economic growth. And certainly one of the places where it's been most vulnerable is on the environmental front, where this extraordinary development we've seen take place
has
had these very deleterious side effects. So I think there, yes, they are making progress, and they recognize they have to do so, or they'll be endangered their own one-party system of rule. But I think what really strikes me about Xi Jinping's regime is that what's been taken off the table is any notion that China is going to reform politically. Economically, yes. Politically, no. And they look at the United States. They look at Congress. They look at Europe, and they look at the state of government.
And they say, we have a better system.
They say, this is no model.
More efficient system.
So, in other words, they get confirmed in the notion that maybe they do have a more viable political model that they should sort of start standing up for and proclaiming rather than just accepting.
But that political model simply is that the Communist Party controls the politics.
Yes, but it can get stuff done.
Yeah.
And that's
it's
a very...
efficient. So if they decide they need a stimulus, they just donate, they
so that's,
sign
that,
the check.
And, I mean, there are even people in the West who are now speaking with a certain strange admiration for this form of governance.
The merits of state capitalism, they say.
Yes.
But can it get things done? I mean, Beijing is facing mounting crisis on the environmental front. You can't breathe in Beijing, basically. Food safety, it's unable to ensure minimum standards of food safety. There are food safety scandals every week, every day. And I'm not talking about some product being contaminated. I'm talking about thousands of dead pigs flowing down the river of Shanghai, the financial capital of the city. They've been unable...
Of dead pigs floating down the river in Shanghai.
Yes.
And they still haven't figured out where they came from.
Where they came from, yeah. I'm just thinking, I remember sitting and watching that river, and I can't imagine what it's like to see thousands of dead pigs floating down.
And they're basically facing many complex social challenges that they don't know how to respond to without using force and repression.
What restrains them then? What's the...
In Hong Kong?
Yeah, well, in generally. I mean, in Hong Kong, in Beijing, in Shanghai, throughout all the provinces, what is the restraining influence?
Well, so
other than
far,
simply doing what we think we want to do?
Well, so far, it has been the unspoken contract that Chinese people can enrich themselves and can pursue wealth.
We'll take care of the politics if you leave us alone.
You don't thread on our turf, which is politics.
Yeah, but so in the end, it's the worry about the dominance of the Communist Party that propels them.
Ultimately, that's the biggest, that number one concern is to maintain the monopoly and power of the Communist Party.
What about the idea of wanting to be a stakeholder, as Robert Zoellick once said?
Well, I mean, this is China's great challenge.
Who wants to do that?
Yeah, but it wants to be equal. It wants to be a great power, and yet it is very reluctant at this stage to sort of shoulder the full measure of
responsibility. And do they believe the United States wants to restrain them from being a great power, or some do, some don't?
They certainly think that the United States, with its pivot to Asia, is out to sort of circumscribe them and contain them. On the other hand, I think there's tremendous affection for America. There's tremendous admiration for America. So it's a very complicated sort of love, hate, attraction, repulsion mechanism that goes on.
So how does this change?
Well, I've been around watching this for a long time, and several generations have gone by, and I've heard people say, wait for the next generation.
Yeah, exactly.
What is so interesting to me is the way in which this sort of powerful patriotism that manifests itself in terms of nationalism, even if they don't approve of their form of government or one thing or another, but this sense of wanting China to be respected in the world is a very deep
force.
But
if that's true, you would think that with respect to Tibet and Hong Kong and not having people protest that and being judged by being showing a certain, informed attitude about these things would be a positive thing to be respected.
Yes, well, this is the great contradiction, that at the same time there's a yearning to be respected and a yearning to gain soft power in the world. Yeah. They do these various things which mitigate against that happening. So it's a kind of a tremendous unresolved dilemma. And I think there is no resolution for it, given the way the present system is constructed.
For a while, there was this, and I've had this conversation a thousand times at this table, there was the notion that right now China just wanted to focus on peace and prosperity. You know, we want to develop this economy to make sure that we can get it to its strongest point, and also that it will serve as somehow to modify the tensions within the society, whether they're rural, urban, or whatever they might be. Normally, you both know more about this than I do. And then at some point, when it felt like it had maximized that, it would turn to being a broader, more participatory citizen in the world community.
We're still waiting.
Yeah, I have to say, Charlie, this notion of sort of Western teleology, we're all ultimately going in the same direction historically.
Yeah, right.
I think this is one of the things the Chinese under Xi Jinping are now saying loudly and clearly to us. Our history goes here. Yeah. Your history may go there. We are not in the same dream.
Yeah. Not in the same dream. And what's their dream?
I think the dream, the Zhongguo Meng, as Xi Jinping says, is a dream of China that is resurgent, it is revived, it is strong, and if it isn't respected in the ways you've just alluded to through its soft power, at least it is feared. At least it can... It does not need to worry about being exploited or encroached
upon. So that brings me back to Hong Kong.
Yeah.
If you treasure the notion, or if you care about the fact that you're feared, you're not going to allow demonstrations to get out of hand, are you?
Well, if you can control them.
It looks like you're capitulating to the crowd.
Yes, but there is a layer here, and the layer is the Hong Kong government and the chief executive, which is deeply unpopular and was not the choice of Beijing. CY Lang was not the initial choice of Beijing. He had another candidate who was a tycoon, and ultimately they had to change horses and put CY
so
Lang
is his
in
job
charge.
At risk in this?
But oh yeah, very much so.
Okay,
so I don't think that he's going to survive. No, he will have to step down. One of the reasons being exactly what you said is that it will shield Beijing from the responsibility of the mess in Hong Kong. CY Lung also doesn't have the support of the elite, of the Hong Kong elite and the tycoons. They never liked him. So there won't be a lot of resistance in Hong Kong if Beijing chooses to put him aside. I don't think that Beijing has a lot of options there. Besides, Xi Jinping inherited CY Lung as chief executive of Hong Kong.
Right.
He did not choose him. And so it's easier politically to cut the losses of Beijing by sacrificing CY Lung and finding a sort of way of reducing the tension in Hong Kong.
But it's a temporary fix, because if you get rid of CY Lung, you get a new leader appointed essentially by Beijing, and you still have the same dilemma that is making people demonstrate in the street.
Yeah, but what Beijing has to do, we have to remember that the turmoil in Hong Kong that we're witnessing now was not something that anyone could imagine just a few weeks ago. What happened is that students starting to demonstrate, and the use of force, disproportionate force by the police, is what triggered people to converge to protect the students, and then for the leader of Occupy Central, Benny Tai, to declare that the movement was starting now. Without the response by the police, which was disproportionate and under the eyes of the media of the world, this would not have happened. So all that Beijing needs to do is to propose to Hong Kong something that acceptable by the majority of Hong Kong people. It doesn't have to meet the demands of Occupy Central. If it meets the demands of the majority of the Hong Kong people, which is to have a reasonably good government that listen more or less to their needs, then it can buy stability for Hong Kong for another 10 years.
Thank you, Nicholas. I'll leave it there. Thank you, Orwell. Sure. Back in a moment, we'll talk to Congressman Paul Ryan about the Republican Party and his own future. Stay with us.
Hi. From New York City, you're watching Bloomberg Television.
You are watching
Bloomberg Television.
Bloomberg Television.
Did you get that?
Yo, bro, you on woo-woo? You kidding me? Everybody's on woo-woo.
Woo-woo. Lock and load, people.
We're going all in on woo-woo.
Mark, comp us up a profile page.
Susie, write us some posts.
I want sponsored woos. I want targeted woos.
We need an ethnically ambiguous woo-woo mascot.
Dude, are you still on woo-woo?
Nah, man. My mom's on woo-woo.
I think that the Malaysian government creates a very business-friendly environment. They've been working alongside us throughout the 40 over years. We wouldn't be where we are today without that support. And obviously, that support would continue.
Malaysia is at the forefront of success. We have very talented people, world-class infrastructure, and we provide a very strategic environment for businesses to grow.
We all have to plan for retirement. But when we start worrying about tomorrow, we miss out on what matters today. At AXA, we offer advice and help you break down your retirement goals into small, manageable steps. Because when you plan for tomorrow, it helps you live for today. Can we help you take a small step? For advice, retirement, and life insurance, connect with AXA.
Paul Ryan is here. He is a Wisconsin congressman and House Budget Committee chairman. He also ran as the Republican vice presidential candidate alongside Mitt Romney in 2012. He has some new thoughts on poverty, conservatism, and renewing the American idea. He explains them in a new book, The Way Forward. I am pleased to have Paul Ryan at this table. Welcome.
Good to be back.
So
nice to see
what
you.
Does this come from? Because you wrote a book, I guess, how many years ago, which is also a similar idea.
Well, this comes from my own experiences growing up.
So it's all part memoir.
It's part memoir. It's part why I am who I am, why I think the way I think, and the environment I grew up in and how it shaped me and gave me a real appreciation for community, for the American idea. And then it's also a description of two different governing philosophies, liberal progressivism and founding governing philosophy, and how, if you don't like the track that the country is on right now, which I don't, and I think a lot of people agree with that, how we should do things differently. Okay. I think we need to offer alternatives as conservatives, and what a conservative governing coalition looks like that's principled, inclusive, aspirational, and therefore hopefully able to get a majority of Americans to support.
The reason I ask where does it come from, because my impression is that you've gotten smarter in the last several years.
Yeah, I've learned a lot. That's one way of putting it.
Yes. You learn things from the campaign.
Yeah.
You learn that, you know, certain phrases you had used.
Yes. Yeah.
Were wrong.
Yeah, I made some mistakes. And I think you need to own up. That's the other thing is people in public life, for some reason, they don't think it's right to own up to mistakes. Yeah. In private lives, we're supposed to. I mean, as adults. So I made some mistakes, and I own up to those mistakes I can learn from them.
Things like saying makers and takers.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
And what made you change your mind about that?
You know, it was actually...
And what did you mean when you said it?
It was... What I meant when I said it was that we have a system where too many people are becoming dependent upon the government, and there won't be enough people paying for the government to keep that kind of a system going. And what I meant to say is we need to focus on getting people off of welfare into work. We need to focus on getting people to where they want to get in life so that they can be upwardly mobile, so they can be self-sufficient, so they can reach their dreams. Because the whole American idea, as I describe here, is that the condition of your birth in this country doesn't determine the outcome of your life. And the role and goal of government is to protect our natural rights and promote equality of opportunity so we can make the most of our lives. And I was trying to articulate the fact that our system, our federal government, has gotten too big, it's gotten too top-down, too coercive, and a lot of people aren't seeing this. A lot of people aren't getting this opportunity.
But what came out of it in terms
of... What came out of that is I was slighting people who are depending upon government who earned benefits.
Yeah, that somehow everybody was poor because they were lazy.
That's right. And so that was not what I meant to say. But it took a liberal Democrat at the Rock County Fair in Janesville, Wisconsin, to come up to me and tell me really what it sounded like. And I realized after this guy kind of laid into me, you know what, he's right. I think it does come across that way. So I need to change the way I talk and the thinking behind it, so that I can communicate more effectively, which is we want a system where everybody can make the most of their lives. Those of us who are conservatives, that doesn't mean we're for no government. We want government to be effective and limited so that it can do what it's supposed to do well to help get people where they need to be in life.
Governor Romney had the same problem with his 47% comments, didn't he?
Yeah, he did.
Same thing.
Mm-hmm.
That some other people, 47%.
Which is wrong, because what we are trying to communicate is we want to have a system so that everybody can get to where they want to get in life. And I would argue that the governing philosophy that's prevailing in Washington right now, spreading the government too widely, doing nothing very well, having a huge mountain of debt that is occurring, and having sort of a top-down approach to growing the economy, a top-down approach to society. It's crowding out civil society. We're 50 years in the war on poverty, and poverty is the highest rate in a generation, 45 million people in poverty. It's not working the way it ought to be working. And so those of us who don't like this direction need to show how we would do things differently. So that's why I think we need to put up, here's a better energy policy. Here's a better healthcare system. Here's smarter educational policies. Here's how you balance the budget, pay off the debt. Here's a more effective way at fighting poverty. Those kinds of things are what we as conservatives need to offer.
Stay with your principal philosophy you were talking about. It seems to me, and you tell me if this is not what you believe, that most people would believe what you said. We want to create a system in which everybody has an opportunity to do what to achieve their dream.
That's right.
Democrats, Republicans,
that's
liberals,
right.
Progressives, conservatives,
right.
All agree with that. The question comes down to who has the best ideas.
I think that's right.
To get there.
I think that's right.
It's not that one person believes, hates the poor, and one person loves the poor. It's that everybody believes in the American ideal.
I think that's...
How do you get there?
I agree with that. And what I'm trying to say is, in this hyper-polarized time we're in, I would like to think that there is a majority in this country that, if given a very clear mandate, a very clear choice, built upon a clear governing philosophy, that we can recapture that spirit in this country.